Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. We engage in the study of the Hebrew Bible in its ancient Near Eastern context and original languages to promote good and reasonable interpretation of Scripture so that the church might live more faithfully in the present. Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Matthew Delaney. As always, I have Dr. Nathan French with me, and today we have a special guest who has returned, Dr. Gary Snitker. We're very excited to have him back. Mm-hmm. So thanks for joining us again to have a good discussion about the Hebrew Bible.
Nathan, Matthew, thank you very much for having me on. I know it wasn't too long since the last time I was on, but had a good time, and I'm glad to be back.
So in case you missed our previous discussion, look back in the archive on the podcast or YouTube, and you can hear us talking with Dr. Gary about his book on the Torah called Torah Story. Excellent book. Highly recommend it. And I think our discussion today flows perfectly from our last discussion, because your latest book is Old Testament Narrative Books, The Israel Story. And here's a picture for those of you on YouTube who want to get a look at what it looks like. Because we ended with Deuteronomy, and here in your book, you're picking up where we left off of.
Exactly.
So I'm really excited for us to discuss this book. So we have a lot of different questions because the narrative books are huge. There's no way we can cover everything. Yeah. So before we dive into some interesting, fun, specific questions, can you just tell us a little bit about this book project? And also, can you talk about how you structured it? Because Nathan and I both are really interested in how you chose to structure each book.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew and Nathan, really. I think there's two, I guess, mechanical issues for the series. The one is a smaller mechanical issue, and that is we wanted short and substantive textbooks. I mean, you're both aware of how radically things have changed in a higher education classroom. And, you know, the big fat textbooks are just getting more and more onerous for certain contexts. So we wanted short, substantive textbooks. I know it sounds like a contradiction, but that's what I've really pressed on the authors who have signed on to this series. Then the other thing is connections. And so connection is, I guess, sort of a metaphor or a play on context, but there's ancient connections, biblical connections, gospel connections, and life connections. And so every one of these textbooks, which goes over a part of the Bible, treats each book and then deals with each of those kinds of connections intentionally and straightforwardly. And different authors have handled them a different way, but I put all the ancient connections sort of as asides about where they fit along the way. Treat biblical connections as really the central thing of what I do. And then I put a dedicated section to gospel connections, pretty short usually, and then life connections at the end of each chapter.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think it's a very helpful way to structure the books because those are four categories that many people are looking for anyway, right? Mm-hmm. They want to see, how is this story understood in its ancient context? How is this understood in its biblical context? Yeah. How does this connect to the gospel? And how does this connect to me? And it makes it really easy with the way you've laid it out visually, right? You can quickly, if you're reviewing the book, where were the ancient connections part? Oh, there it is. Or how does this connect here? You can quickly find it. As with your other book, there are also some nice visuals here. So really great. Yeah. Before we dive in any further, Gary is generous enough to do another giveaway with us. So for those of you who are listening or watching this video, the week that we release it, you can go to any of our social media outlets where I'll make a post about this episode. And if you share this post on your social media account, then you will have a chance to receive a giveaway. We're doing two book giveaways. And for logistical reasons, it needs to be in North America. So sorry to our international listeners, but for this one, it needs to be in North America, US or Canada. So as long as you have an address there, then you can get that. Make sure you tag us so that way I see it, by the way. So without further ado, let's just talk about the historical books. There's a lot of places we could go here. Let me just dive right in. I'll ask a first question. I remember learning that books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. In the Hebrew tradition, they're technically in the prophets section. And can you maybe discuss, you talk about this, what's the paradigm shift that happens when we view these history books from a prophetic perspective? How does that even make sense? And what does that do for us as the reader?
Yeah, I think the most important point first is the purpose of these books. Why are they the way they are in a series? And so I think that the exile, the captivity of the Judeans just overwhelmed them with a tremendous contradiction between reality and everything that they had believed up to that point. I think the contradiction is especially sharp relative to the Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant. These really big umbrella promises where the people believed we're going to be in this land forever and we're going to have a king on the throne forever. And the exile just flatly contradicted those. And I think that those first couple of waves of exiles from Jerusalem just their worlds were shattered. And so they might have remembered, you know, it was just not long ago in Jerusalem where the false prophet Jeremiah was saying that this would happen. And so he was imprisoned, he was abused. And now all of a sudden, when his word comes true, the people come to realize who are trusting in the Lord, hey, maybe Jeremiah wasn't a false prophet. Does anybody have a copy of his scroll? We need to read it. And so I think that those just centuries long viewpoints that were shattered so instantly by the Babylonian exile demanded an explanation. And of course, the prophets had been saying this for decades and centuries even, that they'd been warning this would happen. And there's a warning, there's warnings for this even in the Torah. Right. But it still is something that caught people by surprise. They just maybe thought that was flowery language or something. So in any case, as I see it, these narratives are reformatting or repositioning the identity of the Judeans who embrace it. They have a severe identity crisis, and they need to understand who they are. And so the serial narrative, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, about the rise and the fall of the Hebrew kingdoms, that explains who they are, why they are where they are, and what hope they have for the future. And so in that sense, you know, if we look at the big genre labels, these are historical narratives, and we can call them that, and everyone does, and they offer a really good insight into, you know, the history of the time. But that's not their purpose. They're not here to just, you know, memorialize these antiquarian things. They're not for that. They're primarily to tell a story to reshape the identity of God's people. So I think in a real sense, then the narrative interpretation that they house these four books as we know them. Because they certainly weren't written from scratch right then. I mean, they're put together this way at that point. These books complement the so-called latter prophets. And so together they bear witness. One tells the story of who the people are. The other, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 prophets, offer sustained and extended testimony as to why all of this had to happen, and that the exile, far from contradicting the covenant made it necessary.
Yeah. And
so that's one of the big messages that comes through, inevitability of the exile.
Yeah, that's so helpful. I remember growing up and first encountering the historical books, and that's how they were taught to me. So I assumed, okay, I'm reading history textbooks in my history classes in middle school. So that's what the Book of Kings is. It's the history textbook for ancient Israel, but it's a totally different approach when you realize there's a purpose and there's a main point other than just cursory overview information for the sake of cursory overview information. So I think that that really will unlock a lot for people as they approach these books.
Yeah, and that's part, Matthew, why I don't have historical narratives in the title of the book. They are historical narratives, but I'm really emphasizing these are the narrative books and the narrative function of these historical narratives.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of your gifts, though, you know, is that story, right, is a word that's used in both of your most recent books, because that's something you're great at doing, is showing people how this is a story, even if it's an ancient one, and sometimes it doesn't fit our conceptions of exactly how you tell one, realizing these are stories. It makes it more engaging, and we get more meaning out of it. Nathan, you were going to say something.
Well, I like too how we're talking about the prophets and their impact upon these historical narratives, and then of course, I'm sorry, these Old Testament narrative books, as you like to call it, and then of course the Torah. How when we bring the Torah in and the covenant, you really don't get these narratives unless there is an interpretive lens from that perspective, especially. And I think that's so important for our listeners and hearers and those who read these texts to know that the writers and the redactors, they want you to know that this interpretation is based upon that covenant. And this is why this is happening the way it's happening. And I think you've done such an excellent job of making that clear within this particular book. So,
well, I think, Nathan, that you're right that we have to press that home. And that's almost the, I guess, the covenantal glue that holds it together.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, what's so different, people that are not familiar with it, when we look at, say, the Neo-Assyrian royal inscriptions, they're utterly different than this four-part serial narrative. Mm-hmm. The scribes for the Assyrian kings wrote in first person as though the kings were all saying this. They're very boastful and arrogant. Mm-hmm. They're self-centered. They don't do anything wrong. The gods are always smiling upon them. They never lose any battles.
Yeah.
And so what we have here is a very much more prophetic story. And you're right. I mean, the covenant is shot through it. That's the very much how the prophets that's the compass by which the prophets are evaluating the narration. But the prophetic voices, they're not against the kings, but they're almost like the loyal opposition. So they're pushing back everywhere and criticizing in a way that we just don't see in any of the literature that's sponsored by the crown in competing cultures of the ancient world.
It's good. No, it's so good. So on that note, then, let's talk a little bit about Samuel/Kings and Chronicles for our listeners. So how would you describe the differences between Samuel/Kings and Chronicles so we can appreciate these particular books? Now, I always love with my students bringing up the emphasis of the chronicler and what the chronicler is doing, and especially to any of those students of mine who might be ignorant of this fact that Chronicles is really doing something interesting with Samuel and Kings. It's always quite a shocker and quite a moment for some of my students. So walk us through that, if you would.
Yeah, that's excellent. And it sounds like we really are sharing a lot of similar push on our students that might have a predisposition against
me. Yeah.
I think it's important to note right at the offset is when we look at the four-part serial narrative, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, or even just the last two parts, Samuel and Kings, these are not all written at once by a historian/novelist like we might have today. They're pieced together out of very disparate and different kinds of source material and literature. So they don't read the same at all. So all right. Even Samuel versus Kings, they really are strange partners in doing the work of telling the story of the rise and the fall of the Hebrew kingdoms. Samuel is extremely literary in many of its sections. It's personal. We really feel like we get to know David. He's a complicated character. He contradicts himself. He's very emotional. He says things and takes them back. He kills people. Men love him. Women love him. everyone loves David. Even his enemies usually have a love-hate with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a masterful piece of ancient literature, much like Ruth or Genesis. Kings, on the other hand, is put together, I know you know this, and this is what you're asking me, it's put together of like three kinds of literature. There's these royal annals or inscriptions from the southern kingdom. There's royal annals and inscriptions from the northern kingdom. And then, they're put together, if you can, only this is for the people on YouTube, they're interweaved in the middle part of Kings. But then in that interweaved middle part, there's also a collection of very colorful northern prophet stories that are not dated. And they're all just stuck in where they might fit in between the interweaved northern and southern sort of dry formulaic. Even that, I mean, it's driven by formulas. And so it's very static in Kings. We don't really get to know even Solomon. There's some 10 chapters or so about him, but only chapter 3 do we get to know him a little bit, when the Lord comes to him at Gibeon in a vision, when he says, chop that baby in half. Those are moments where we feel like, oh, I'm getting to know Solomon. But beyond that, we're really at a distance from him and most of the other kings.
Mm.
And the author of Kings is always afraid. He doesn't want us to misinterpret anything. So we're told right up front, this king did evil in the eyes of the Lord, or this king did good in the eyes of the Lord. So we get the interpretation up front, and then there's a static presentation of the king. So in short, Samuel and Kings then, they do fit together, and we can see, right, the editor, or you use the word redactor, that's fine, a collector, has used some of the same formula that we see in Kings is overlaid onto Saul and David in Samuel, so that there is this sense of continuity in these very different kinds of literature. But then when we come to Chronicles, though Chronicles is largely made up of Samuel and Kings, we're in a very different world. And so if we approach it as its own retelling of an old story, and I take it as retelling of a authoritative story, we're supposed to know the story of Samuel and Kings very well and notice all the tweaks, adjustments, and big changes that are in Chronicles. And so that's kind of almost what's, I kind of think as of the chronicler as being, though he's very conservative, mathematically so, he's also pretty daring as far as a literary author. he's gutsy. And he also, he's not very ironic, but he's willing to push the envelope and really press his reading constituents pretty hard on a story that they think they know really well. So we find again and again, there are kings that in Chronicles version who are bad, then they have an experience and they become good.
Yeah.
They're good, then they have an experience and they become bad. So there's a dynamic treatment of many of the kings who are treated statically and flatly in Kings. And I think the other thing that, is just really important is the centrality of worship in Chronicles. The purpose of the Davidic kings, they're patrons of the temple. So any stories that are not about the kingdom or Jerusalem or the Levites or the temple, they're just not in there. So the whole book is orbiting the temple. And that's really the issue with Chronicles, right? It's written, I guess, if we dated around 400 BCE, and I'm inclined to do that, give or take, but no sooner than that. That's going to put it a good 160 years after the likely writing of the Book of Kings, based upon the release of Jehoiachin from his confinement there in Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think a lot of moderns don't realize when we read the Bible, 160 years in the ancient world is just as long and just as complicated as 160 years in modern times.
That's good. Yeah.
And if we think back, you know, 160 years ago right now, the Civil War wasn't even over yet. Yeah. And like we think of all the cataclysmic things that have happened in the United States in these past 160 years. And there's all these lingering problems and everything. So there's continuity for sure, but a lot has changed.
Yeah.
And if we think about Judah in exile and Judah returned to Jerusalem in this economic depression that they're facing and really wondering who they are and why they're worshiping in this temple, these are much more dramatic changes in their 160 years than the ones we've experienced in our situation. And so the chronicler needed to use this old story, but he's redefining the identity of the people once again. People that, hey, we can join David. We do join David. We join Solomon. We're worshiping in the same place. And it's the, right, there's a continuity that transcends these dramatic differences in the setting of the post-exilic constituents of Chronicles.
So it's
a very different kind of a story, even though it's mostly made up of the old story.
I have a follow-up question about Chronicles that I've always been curious about. I think some of the unfortunate ways we approach Chronicles is perhaps due to where it's located in our Bibles, that it's very common that most people encounter Chronicles as immediately after Kings. And again, growing up, I felt like it already doesn't help that it's a lot of genealogy at the beginning, which is hard for us to appreciate. but even that aside, once you get your way through that slog, you then think, oh, I already read these stories. And it feels like a review that's way too early. And it's like, you know what, just fine, skip it, or I'll skim it or whatever, on to the next thing. But then learning that in some of our ancient Hebrew codices, that the Masoretic texts, like the Leningrad, Aleppo, Sassoon, they place Chronicles at the beginning of the Ketuvim, right before Psalms in the third section. So it's many books removed, and it's at the head of that third section. Or as has become most common in modern printed Jewish Bibles, is at the end of the Ketuvim, as the last and final book of the Bible. So do you have any thoughts on, does the canonical location of Chronicles impact the way that we approach it as its story?
Yeah, for sure. And I'll just say this and come back to it, but I'm not following any of the canonical orders in the way I've arranged the chapters of this book. But I think you're right, Matthew, that the Chronicles has always gotten a bad sort of rift in the Septuagintal and Christian Bible order. Cummings, it does right after Kings, because it does seem like more of the same. And we're not prepared by the four verses of exile that we read at the end of Kings.
That's a good point.
You know, why rehash the whole story, right? Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult ride there. But there's a certain sense, of course, to the Christian Bible order. I mean, it's just all the narrative books, more or less in chronological sequence based on their contents. And so that makes sense. Especially, it should make sense in a context where people really know the rest of the scriptures. But I mean, historically, Chronicles has really not done well in its location in the Christian Bible. I think that's right. In the Torah, prophets, Ketuvim, the writings, if Chronicles is at the head of the writing, so it's after the prophets, and so there's, just starting this new thing. So it begins with Adam, retells the story of the Davidic kingdom, and ends with the Edict of Cyrus. In that sense, it creates a framework for the Ketuvim. And so, you know, the attention to the worship really works well off of that. The attention to David's genealogy, wisdom, all of those things. And even the books of theodicy and exile, they all work really well with Chronicles sort of setting the framework or setting the table for those. And then, and I think you probably know this, but I think BHQ, they're intending to put it in that order. once they are put they? PHQ together, they're going to start the Ketuvim with Chronicles.
Oh, thank you. So that has been a pet peeve of mine for so long. I'm like, if your goal is to represent the Leningrad Codex, yet you make a little footnote and say, but we're going to put Chronicles later. It's like, what are we trying to do here? Are we trying to match modern orders?
I'm listening for them. They might change their mind right at the last minute.
Oh, man.
But in any case, yeah, the BHS, which all of us are familiar with, puts Chronicles at the end. And, you know, it's a really good spot for it in another way, because coming through Lamentations and Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, right, we realize how dramatic and tragic the exile is. Mm-hmm. But having Ezra, Nehemiah first reminds us of Malachi and just how disappointing the restoration was.
Yeah.
And so when we recognize the failure of the restoration and how it's struggling, that's the constituency of Chronicles. So that helps us to join with the readership and say, hey, here's who this book is for. It's written for people that really haven't found their way in trying to bring everything back, because, I mean, they're bold and daring to go back to this economically depressed hinterlands of Judah, which was decimated by Nebuchadnezzar and took centuries to get over that. But many of them probably had high hopes reading their prophetic books and thinking about, well, Isaiah said this and the other prophets said that. And they have a really disappointing reality reading those prophets so expectantly and living out this very meager and troubled life in the hinterlands of Judah. Yeah. And so they need Chronicles very badly. They need to know who they are. And so anyway, in very, very short terms, I in my book, I just treated the four-part serial narrative first, the rise and the fall of the Hebrew kingdom that we've talked about, Joshua, mm-hmm. Judges, Samuel, Kings. And the other narrative books, they're thematically all related to exile and return or restoration.
Yeah.
So just based on the contents of the book, I placed them in chronological sequence, and I put Chronicles at the end. I really wasn't sure what to do, but I decided, because it's sort of a overview of the whole thing, I put Chronicles last. Begins with Adam, goes to the Edict of Cyrus.
Mm. Sure. Well, that's so helpful. Chronicles is a personal, you know, it's in my top 10, and I think it gets such a bad rap, and I hope people can appreciate approaching as its own story. So thanks for giving all that. I think you've given us a really good segue, by the way, unless Nathan, you have any follow-up thoughts before our next question.
No. I like the segue, because I think he has given us a good segue here.
You've given us a really nice segue with chronology, because I think our listeners would be shocked, I think, to learn that the way that the ancient biblical authors told stories was not always so straightforward, pun intended. sorry, my dad. Now I have dad jokes. It's bad. So I wonder, though, if the book of Judges, I think our listeners would be shocked. In fact, I'm not going to spoil it. You just take us away with the book of Judges, how there's something surprising in the structure of the book.
Well, I'm going to just tell your listeners then, this is a spoiler alert. If you want to enjoy the surprise ending of the book of Judges for yourself, pause the video, read Judges, and come back to it. I think that what we're not prepared for is, I think that the author of Judges might wink at us or something, but the author tricks us, because he sets us up for a story that's getting worse and worse. And I mean, we've all gotten that. This is Judges 2:19. But whenever the judge died, they would relapse and behave worse than their ancestors. And I think that, you know, I think every interpretation of Judges gets that. And we all emphasize the downward slide of the book, and things go from bad to worse. And nothing gets better in Judges. So what surprises us a little bit is, after the the horrible judging of Gideon, Jephthah, and mm-hmm. Samson, we think, how much worse could it get? But the book of JoJo's does not disappoint. It ends with these two doozy episodes that are so bad that, based on this formula that we've been hearing, and the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Mm. You know, we hear that again and again. Now all of a sudden, there's no eyes of the Lord at all. It's people do whatever is right in their own eyes in the two last episodes. And so the one episode of the Danite debacle, just a complicated story, but it is about worshiping wherever you want in the wrong way. And so it's a play off of a saying in the place legislation of Deuteronomy 12, where people do what's right in their own eyes. They worship wherever they want. And so here's a story where the Danites do that. They get a priest who's sort of just doing his own thing, and then they take the priest, and they don't move to the land that God promised them. They move to a land where there's some weaklings, and they take their land, and they just move wherever they want, and they set up their own worship. So it perfectly fits that saying where they're just doing what's right in their own eyes. And things are so bad. You know, it's not just that they don't do evil in the eyes of the Lord. Well, they do, but it's not said. But even the use of the Lord's name, Yahweh, every time it comes up, it's so ironic in this terrible story. The mother of the character Micah there says, "Oh, my son, thank you for returning this stolen silver. May you use it to make an idol of Yahweh." what are you talking about? And when they are looking, the Danites, to move to the wrong place, they get a blessing. Oh, yes, this is good in the eyes of Yahweh. So every time we hear the divine name of the Lord there, it's such a dizzying and disorienting thing.
Yeah, that's good.
And at the end of that episode, as you know, in chapter 18, verse 30, the identity of this young renegade priest is identified. This is the grandson of Moses. So this is Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Moses. And we realize all of a sudden, wow, this is pretty early in the timeline. And what's even underlines it even more, the author of Judges uses the word young 5 times to describe how, you know, this is Moses' grandson when he's young. And so we all know that Gershom was already born before the Exodus. And so if Jonathan's young, I mean, this is very early in the days right after Joshua. I mean, just about immediate. Then, of course, the last story is the terrible story of high hypocrisy and sexual abuse and just the brutal treatments in the highlands of Benjamin, which almost caused a civil war and almost wiped a tribe out. And then the really striking hypocrisy of the leaders at the end, who they went to a civil war to clean things up with the way Benjamin was acting. But in their overkill, they almost wiped Benjamin out. So here's the solution. Tell you what, guys, go up to Shiloh and sneak in there and steal virgin girls and run away with them, and we'll protect you. It's like,
yikes.
Yikes. Wow, you've really cleaned everything up. Good for you guys. I mean, way to go. And in the midst of the story, in chapter 20 and verse 28, we learn that one of the times they're seeking God's will in all this, that they come to Tabernacle, and who is in charge of things there? Well, none other than Phinehas, the grandson of Abraham. Abraham. Wow, that is early.
Man, real early. Real early.
Plot twist.
It's the grandson of
Aaron. Jacob is not who you think he is.
Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron. Yeah. So anyway, both of these terrible, terrible stories are practically the first thing that happens when the people get into the land.
Yeah.
So I think what the narrator is doing is we have this experience going through of things getting worse and worse and worse. And we can almost imagine how the people of Israel felt, saying, Oh, I just remember the good old days. I wish we could go back to the good old days when we first entered the land.
Yeah.
And what the author does is just pulls that rug out from under them, saying, hey, there is no such thing as the good old days for Israel in the land.
Yeah.
As bad as things could get, that's how it was immediately in the days the grandchildren of the people that were brought from Egypt through the wilderness to this land. Things instantly got that bad. So I think part of the purpose of that, and that's where we especially need to keep our eyes on the big picture, is this is really going a long way to proving that the exile is inevitable. I mean, the people, you know, really didn't deserve what God had given them and protected them to have. And so this is part of the big story of explaining exile. And I think maybe one other point there that goes along with that is in verse 31, chapter 18, verse 31. It speaks to the exile, at least of the northern kingdom. So this is, you know, these are very ancient events when they're put into this order. So this is looking back at the days of the judges from an exilic perspective. So we kind of need to take that distance with the original readership. These were not written, they might have been written contemporary, but the book is framed not contemporary with the events that happened or even close after them. This is looking way back. This is a lesson for exile.
And I think you really point something out there, especially with Judges, that idolatry isn't just, according to these books, isn't just the worship of idols, though it includes that for sure.
Yeah.
But it's how you worship, right, and where you worship. And so much of that is intertwined within the text, and the text is wanting us to know that if you're not doing it the way that it was prescribed to be done according to the covenant, then the result is going to be extreme moral failure, and that's what you get ultimately. And it leads us. It's interesting with Judges. You always get these questions: how is this in the Bible? Which is, it's there for a reason. It wants you to come to the end to know there is a complete and utter collapse of what was supposed to be,
right,
with covenant faithfulness. Yeah.
And I think even that phrase that's borrowed from Deuteronomy 12, people doing what's right in their own eyes.
Yeah.
Well, it fits exactly to what the Danites had done. But when we move it over to the Benjaminite debacle, all of a sudden that's stretching the sense of it out. That's not about worship. I mean, that story has nothing, I don't want to say nothing to do with worship, very little to do with worship. I mean, this is just a society that's just falling apart.
Precisely. Yeah.
And, you know, without being all together like they were in the wilderness, it's like anarchy. And so now that phrase takes on a much larger significance, right? In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And so there's what starts with worshiping wrong, as you're pointing out, Nathan, just spills over into a society that's just mayhem. Something that's begging for a king in Israel.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. And then, of course, to bring in the exile as well and to have them say, well, let's look at the good old days. Oh, look, we're in the good old days. I mean, everything has completely collapsed before us. Yes. So, and exactly. So on that note, then, maybe talk to us some about the chronology that you've had to deal with in writing this book. Obviously, there's a lot of debates regarding ancient Near Eastern chronology and even Hebrew Bible chronology. But talk to us about your approach in what you've done in the book.
Yeah, so this case of Judges is being in dischronological, that's a word we use, being in a different sequence in the narrative than how it transpired historically. This is not unusual. This is very common in the Bible, but it's not something that the Bible authors made up. This is something we see in ancient literature from many different cultures running across many centuries. So one place it shows up is in the dischronological presentation of historical facts, is in the Neo-Assyrian royal inscriptions. These are very much written to a formulaic pattern. And here I'm especially thinking, there's a number of scholars who have done work on this, but Doug Green's work is really very fine because he's done a literary analysis of these inscriptions. And he makes the point that the pattern, there's a sort of a narrative arc that the scribes put all of the historical annals into. And the narrative arc is the kings go out to war and defeat the enemies better than their ancestors did. And then they return home with their plunder and do these building projects. Well, they go out to war every year. And in reality, most of them are involved in building projects. They don't wait until the end of their career to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, they have their building supervisors are in constant building mode. So that narrative arc doesn't align with how we would line up the historical elements of the Assyrian kings. That's just the way that we present the career of a king. Mm. The gods give them favor on the battlefield. The gods then give them permission to build a temple and to make a Garden of Eden here on earth, and they do that. The same thing is taken up Cicero in, this is in the Greeks, and so I guess I could even put Aristotle in between. Well, Aristotle's Poetics, of course, talks about all different ways of arranging poetic dramas, but he also is clear that these things apply to histories as well. He doesn't explicitly get into the dischronological, but he does talk about all different kinds of arrangements. But if we move forward in the Greek world, Cicero tells his biographer, I'm going to read this quote. He tells, this is in a letter to Lucius when he wants his biographer to write a good story about him. Quote, "The actual chronological record of events exercises no very powerful fascination upon us. It is like the recital of an almanac." So he's encouraging his biographer to rearrange the story to make it a little bit better. Even a little bit further, and this is just a very small soundbite. This is Lucian, and this is from the 2nd century CE, and we call this writing How to Write History. And he's giving some advice, and he says, quote, "The task of the historian is to arrange events artistically, to exert all his powers to make them vivid," end quote. Wow. So we see that this idea of chronological sequence and telling history, those are modernist values. They're
good.
Not really a part of how good history is told in the ancient world. I mean, they would really probably just laugh at us thinking you've ruined this historical account by putting it in its, you know, chronological sequence. They would say, find the heart of the account. So if we talk about the biblical authors, right, what's the theology that they're trying to say? What's the point? And so the function of the narratives is what drives their arrangement. So we find dischronological narration in the Torah, even in the Gospels, right? We all get that something's going on in Luke when John the Baptist is arrested before he baptizes Jesus, right? That's a different sequence. Moses in Exodus 33 goes into the tabernacle before the tabernacle is built in chapter 40, right? Yeah. So we have this. And in the books, the historical narratives that I've worked on in this book, there's lots and lots of examples, but one would be we find out about Hezekiah giving tribute to Sennacherib, sort of the outcome, before the story is told. So the whole Hezekiah story, the episodes are in exactly reverse order, start at the end and work our way back to the beginning. Similarly, in Ezra chapter 7 and 8, you know, we're about to get into this dramatic story of these civilians, unarmed civilians, taking tons and tons of treasures back to Jerusalem, and they're all worried about it. Well, the very first thing the narrator does is tells us they arrived back in Jerusalem safely. And then the story is told. So we're being invited to know that everything works out. And we're invited to evaluate the stress of Ezra and these other leaders and their calling upon the Lord, knowing the outcome before we get into it. So we're not struggling along with them there. There's lots of reasons for dischronological narration, but the point being is this is just good storytelling in the Bible.
Excellent. Yeah, excellent response.
Yeah, and I think we should realize that although I think when we're telling history, this generally feels foreign, but I think even today, there are some TV shows and movies or books that illustrate how we do value creative storytelling. Like a movie came out a few years ago called Arrival, about an alien invasion that was very creative, had a huge plot twist at the end that made you like realize, oh, this is how time was working.
Yeah.
Or Christopher Nolan is a very famous movie director who he's been very creative in some of his movies on perception of reality. I understand those are fiction, and we might still feel like, no, you could never do that with nonfiction. But we at least understand intuitively there is some logic to why you would want to do that as a storyteller. And you've already quoted some ancient historians who they're very open about their process.
Yeah, I think that's important, Matthew. And don't want to get into a big tirade about it, but just I think we need to really, I guess, emphasize that there's no contradiction for the ancients between literary art and historical veracity.
Yeah.
That, you know, they would say, we have to tell the story in the way that brings the truth of this historical realities out. And a lot of times that might be rearranging and juxtaposing things in a way to bring that theology to the fore. And none of the biblical authors are shy about this.
That's really good. That's really clear.
So I want to turn away. Well, here's what I want to ask you as far as your teaching experience. So in all of your experience in teaching at the university level, what would you say students find most difficult when it comes to engaging with the historical books of the Hebrew Bible?
And Nathan, you shared with me that you were going to ask this question, so I've been thinking about it. And probably the true answer is there's not one thing, there's a million things.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe it's a lot of individual, but if I am stepping back and doing some generalizing, you got me to think about, I guess this is my headline, the embarrassment that many seminary students and many university students have about Old Testament. Now, we, you know, in our classes, like yours and mine, hopefully, you know, the Old Testament is at home and we're all at home wrestling with it and arguing about it. But there's maybe at least three sources of embarrassment for the students. I mean, one is very well known and doesn't need much of a point, but, you know, our larger culture from which was very influential upon student age people, both at graduate studies and undergraduate studies, the Old Testament is just taken to be flatly about a, you know, the God of Israel is a God that hates people.
Right.
So there's just a real negative stigma about the Old Testament. And students feel a little embarrassed about that. But surprisingly, even, you know, if we talk about the church, even within that context, there's been a growing embarrassment about for students about the Old Testament, because at church, you know, there's maybe not your church, but at church, a lot of times the Old Testament is just viewed as this legalistic problem. And there's, you know, there's a real sense of, wow, it's so nice that we don't have to deal with that anymore because we have a New Testament. And, you know, Jesus isn't like that. He's really nice. And, you know, he holds children and, you know, just everything's great in the New Testament. So that there's that general negativity about the Old Testament that's more and more pervasive, even within church and Christian circles.
Yeah.
And I think finally, if we just, you know, face it, that outside of seminary or outside of the biblical studies classes, the Bible's not as interesting as movies and video games and the really interesting things that are trending on TikTok and in our culture. And so I think that no matter where we turn, outside of our actual academic environment, I just think that students really struggle with a sense of embarrassment of, you know, taking seriously and devoting this kind of study to the Old Testament. I don't know if that's a good answer, Nathan, and I might revise it next week, but I've just been thinking about this.
Yeah. You know,
there's it's not just one kind of embarrassment.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a shame that goes with the Old Testament from several quarters that students find themselves in today.
No, that's very good. Very good. And I concur with you on that. I mean, there really is a sense of shame, even within the church, it seems, between the two. And I mean, not to go down a rabbit trail, but when you read the New Testament, I often push back on students and say, well, have you read the New Testament? I mean, there's pretty hard things to be said there too. So yes, it's like,
I think, one of the exercises I do with my Torah students is, I have a list of New Testament commands, and there's over 830. Yeah. And so I have students look over that and find the weird ones. And then from that starting point, say, hey, do you know there's only 613 laws in Torah?
Exactly.
There's some weird ones, but there's weird ones in the New Testament too. And that's just a really different, I found that to be a way to just get into, you know, the whole framework of God's demands in the Old Testament, in comparing it to something that people are more sympathetic to, that is the New Testament.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. And I think too, just the lack of the Old Testament within culture anymore is within our conscience, it seems. My wife and I named our second son Boaz. And the night he was born, they asked what his name was. We said Boaz. And the doctors and the nurse, there was only one nurse, but she came in at a later point. Nobody had heard the name Boaz. I was like, where did you get the name Boaz? And I thought, okay, we have a problem.
My uncle in Tennessee.
Exactly. Right, is Bo. So, but anyways, I think it just goes to show that these narratives and stories are not, they're not in the conscience of the public anymore, it seems. So, yeah.
To bring things full circle, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to hopefully cause a counter shift. But I think one of them is representing these as stories, because I think for the people who are struggling with the presentation of God, often what I find is there's an isolated scene or even an isolated line, and that's what's causing the problem. For example, I had a student who in class was really disturbed about a story in the book of Judges where one of the judges sacrifices his daughter, and he is so put off by this. And it's amazing. I think when he asked the question, he was expecting it to be a beyond difficult question with no possible answer. And not like I am the way, the truth, and life by any means, but I just very briefly said, well, what's the book of Judges about? Where does that scene fit within the story? What is it doing?
Right.
And we realize, oh, that visceral reaction you're having to the story is exactly what the author wants you to feel. This is not like a, hey guys, the Bible secretly has the story that says God wants you to sacrifice kids. Like, no. Like, far be it. Like, the opposite. The point is the opposite of what you've reached.
Exactly.
But again, how do we find that place is as stories. And then the second thing I would add is not just the difficulty of the image of God, but just the lack of engagement. And I think when students realize that it's easier to engage something when you know it is engaging. And the reality is the stories of Scripture, this is some of the greatest literature ever written. And if we don't feel that, the reason is because there's probably something about the history, the culture, or just our understanding of how literature works that we're not getting. And fair enough, this was written a long time ago. So what do you need? It's just a guide, someone who can show you this is amazingly engaging stories. Once you get those tool sets, then it's like, oh, this is great. And once again, shameless plug, if you don't feel like you have a guide, here's one.
Yeah, exactly.
And I know that you've mentioned before that some of your books are designed for multi-purpose, and some you especially have textbook in mind. But even more so than your Torah book, like, this is a book that anyone could just pick up and read. This doesn't, in my opinion, read like a textbook at all. I think that you obviously can use it as a textbook, but this is a great way for someone who wants to be engaged once again with these stories. Here's a guide who can be with you to help open your eyes along the way. So, you know, I wish we had time for all of our questions here. We probably have time for one, maybe two more. I think we should for sure ask our last question. That's my bias. I loved that part of your book that you mentioned. Nathan, is there a different question you want to ask, or do we just want to go to our last question?
Oh, let's go to that last question, because it's a good one. I think we're going to have a good response here. So,
yeah. So you reference a piece of artwork, Dickens' Dream, and say, faithful Christians would do well to surround themselves with scenes from the narratives of Israel's scriptures. Can you give some insight on what this can look like for people who want to incorporate this kind of focus with scripture reading, and with a specific emphasis to the books in this textbook here? But one more preface point to this question, meditating on scripture. In fact, Joshua, the first of those historical books, begins with this idea. And I know many people of faith who take the meditation of scripture seriously. But in my experience, I find that's mostly focused on the line level, where it's, let me find a sentence to meditate on. So can you maybe speak what it would it look like to, if you will, to surround ourselves to meditate on the scenes of Israel's history and the value that has?
Yes, I'll back up for one, just very briefly. I'm not an art critic, but this picture called Dickens' Dreams, you know, it's kind of folksy or whatever, but it's right after Charles Dickens, the beloved novelist, died. An artist drew Dickens, I guess, older in his prime, but dozing off on his study chair where he used to write some of his books. And all around him are just these little clouds of his dreams. And it's all scenes from many of Dickens's beloved books. So that's kind of where the thought comes from. But I think, Matthew, that, and I know, Nathan, you're pointing on this question as well. When I had a chance to visit Israel, my wife gave me a trip there as my PhD, a gift for finishing my PhD. I went there in the year 2000. And I didn't take a camera. And I should have, but I didn't. And I was just too proud because I just had my Bible and my notebook and I was just going to live. I wasn't going to, you know, have this camera on my face the whole time. Well, one of the moments that was just really great about this visit was on the Nazareth Ridge. And of course, they bring all the tourists over to the Nazareth Ridge and we all look down and we see where Jesus was not thrown off this ridge. Right, that's kind of the gist of this, and everybody's wow, and taking all these pictures. I just stepped back and I looked around from what you can see on the Nazareth Ridge, and way down to the left is Mount Tabor, and as you scan across the Jezreel Valley, well, there's Mount Gilboa, and there's the Hill of Moreh, looking across, I mean, you know, you can see the places where Barak and Deborah, and where Gideon's men drank from the brook in different ways. Some of the places where Elijah and Elisha did miracles, where Saul's decapitated body was put up. I mean, so what just struck me, I drew a sketch of it in my notebook, standing there while everyone else was taking pictures, and I wrote down some of these notes, but it struck me, people that grew up in Nazareth are walking around in the physical setting of so many of these Old Testament episodes and stories. I thought, what a profound place to live. And so it really just has stuck with me. And it fits with the same kind of idea. I think maybe part of the answer comes from Deuteronomy 6. Where it's not just love God and keep his commandments, but it's instruct the next generation with these things everywhere, all the time, as you get up and as you walk along and as you, and when the next generation comes and says to you, what do all these commands mean? then there's an answer there for the older generation to give. And the answer is tell them the story of the Exodus.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the meaning of God's will, if you will, in something like that, is for us to tell the stories of redemption, tell of what God has done. These are our stories, in a sense, to make sense of what God's will for us is. Mm. And so I think it's hard for me, you know, when we think about the whole Christian Bible, it's hard for me to imagine how anemic the view of the Jewish Messiah is when we consistently have a framework of creation, fall into sin. Okay, let's go to Golgotha now.
Right.
And we just skip the in-between. And then and it just sort of empties out the significance of our faith in Messiah and
so good
what our Christian faith is all about. Mm. Anyway, so those are, I think, some of the things that I think of, you know, when I have to provide a little bit of commentary about this portrait that was drawn about Dickens.
Yeah, that's inspiring.
Love it.
Very inspiring. Either of you two, any last thoughts as we close?
Thank you for, I know it's obvious, Matthew and Nathan, that, I mean, we're really kindred folk here, and you know, we're doing a lot of the same things in our classes, and we have a lot of the same sensibilities even about books like Chronicles. So it's just a pleasure to spend this time back and forthing with you. Really, thank you for inviting me onto your program.
Yeah, yeah, so good. Yeah, so good to have you. And I think too, you know, on that last point, it's we realize with the Old Testament especially that geography is theology, right? To just put it in everything you were just talking about. I think I'm quoting John Levinson, you know, there from Harvard, but true, it's just so true. And this book is fantastic, Gary. I really, really loved it. And I, as I was telling you before we even came on, it's just so thorough. What you were able to get into this, as you said, it's not a massive volume, but it's so thorough, but yet so well presented, as Matthew said, in a way that you really can pick it up and just read through it. But you will get what you need to get regarding a massive textbook, and I'll just say that. And it's really good. So well done, great work, and thanks, really thankful that you came on and could share with our listeners regarding it. So
excellent,
pleasure. Thank you very much.
So people are going to be listening to this at different times. What are some of the best places for people to get this book if they're interested?
Oh, probably Amazon here in the United States anyway. You know, they deliver quick, cheap prices usually.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. We'll put links to the show notes below. And Gary, thank you once again for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you very much.